on a Thursday. Welcome into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, thanks for being here, folks. Thanks to our Studio Tubers and folks listening on the app and at 90.9 FM. Couple things to start the show here, Cherry. First, I just want to say rest in peace to the great Bob Uecker. We just learned within the last hour or so that he passed away. Most known for his affiliation with the Milwaukee Brewers as a player and a broadcaster. And, of course, for being in the Major League movies, scene stealer there. But also played briefly for the Philadelphia Phillies, so a local tie. Bob Uecker, one of the great baseball personalities.
We wanted to note that.
Also wanted to note at the top of the show, because some folks, I think, are wondering about Studio 2 DJ of the Day, which is a long tradition here. We used to end the week with a song picked by our listeners. That's on pause right now because of some
copyright
stuff, because we're on YouTube now. So hopefully we'll bring it back someday. We do miss Studio 2 DJ of the Day dearly.
Yeah, I thought that was a successful tradition in the making.
It was. We got lots of nominations every week. You know, we love music. We love all of you. Maybe we'll bring that back someday. Now let's get into the main topic today.
Yeah.
The Democrats.
Yeah. The countdown is on for the inauguration, so we're talking about Democrats since then.
So, yeah, they're the minority governing party. They're going to be for at least a couple years, maybe longer. And today we're going to talk to a trio of Democrats about where the party should head over the next 2 to 4 years. What should their message be? How should they deliver that message? And how should they rebuild this party after what happened in November? Mm-hmm. So we'll have Rep. Madeleine Dean.
Yep.
She'll be zooming in from D.C., zooming as in the technology, not she's actually driving in. We'll also have State Senator Nikhil Saval, and we'll also have a Democratic strategist in the last segment, and they're going to just talk about their different visions for where the Democrats should head. Of course, we want to hear from you. What changes should the Democrats make to rebuild a winning coalition? That's our big question for you today. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And if you are a Studio Tuber, hello. Hello,
Hi.
Home Fries. Hello,
Tater Tots.
Collaborators. You can
Tater Collaborators?
Yeah. I like that.
That's that's a good one right there.
Tater Collaborators?
Tater Collaborators.
Collaborate by leaving a comment right there in the YouTube stream. Before we get into all that, a trio of local news stories. Cherry, why don't you start us off today?
Yeah, the confirmation hearings for President-elect Donald Trump's pick for Attorney General. That happened. It started yesterday. Pam Bondi is the nominee. And Pennsylvania and the 2020 election was a topic of conversation. Senators brought up Bondi and her efforts during that 2020 election to deny that Joe Biden won. They brought up the fact that Bondi declared at a news conference here in Philadelphia after the 2020 election that, quote, "We won Pennsylvania and we want every vote to be counted in a fair way." Of course, Joe Biden won Pennsylvania. But during that hearing, Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois asked whether Bondi had any doubts about whether Joe Biden had the majority of votes to win the 2020 election. She declined to answer yes or no. Instead, here's what she had to say.
No one from either side of the aisle should want there to be any issues with election integrity. I accept, of course, that Joe Biden is president of the United States, but what I can tell you is what I saw firsthand when I went to Pennsylvania as an advocate for the campaign. I was an advocate for the campaign, and I was on the ground in Pennsylvania, and I saw many things there.
Yeah, so no definitive answer there.
Well, she saw many things.
She saw many things. Yeah, and I also
maybe mentioned, she saw Reading Terminal Market.
Maybe, but yeah. And by the way,
it would seem to me if you saw voter fraud, you would mention that. But she saw many things
that was not mentioned. No evidence of voter fraud here in Pennsylvania, and we've talked about this. There was no voter fraud here in Pennsylvania. By the way, Senator
not
Chris,
that anyone's ever proven.
Yeah, and Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, who was also you know, at that hearing and asked questions, he focused on that subject as well. He asked specifically what Bondi would do if Trump asked her to do something that was, quote, outside the bounds of ethics or the law. And she said, quote, "I'll never speak on a hypothetical, especially one saying that the president would do something illegal. That was her reply. By the way, if confirmed, she will be the nation's top prosecutor leading the Department of Justice. She will be the lawyer for the United States of America.
Yeah, I remember being in the scrum outside the convention center in November 2020. It was Corey Lewandowski, and I believe she was there. Corey Lewandowski spoke, but was like drowned out by the protesters. And they were talking about they had a minor legal victory while all this was playing out, and they were, you know, crowing about it. And you couldn't really hear them, so they ended up having the thing at Four Seasons. I don't know if she was at the Four Seasons. Yeah.
Yeah, the Giuliani.
Yeah, Giuliani was there, and Lewandowski. I don't know if she was there actually at the second one, but I remember her being there, I believe, at the first one where we couldn't really hear. And man, if you had told me then that she would be
the attorney general pick,
I would have said, you know, after you puff, are you going to pass? I mean, honestly, it's crazy to think that we are here 4 years later. So, second story. This was making waves online.
Yeah, talker.
From Sunday. So, the Eagles, they beat the Packers on Sunday.
Go Birds!
That's the good news.
Yeah.
Bad news is that there was a viral video that took place that showed something that happened in the stands during the game. It was this guy who was an Eagles fan verbally berating, there he is, a Packers fan. And the person that posted it was the fiance of the Packers fan who's being berated. And he claimed that it was like totally unprovoked. And the
Packers fan was a woman.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was totally unprovoked. And like, let's find this guy who was berating her because he used some really misogynistic language. So his associates online, because he's a podcaster, went and found this guy. His name's Ryan Caldwell, and he was fired from his job in New Jersey. And the company that he works for has like a focus on DEI, which was a crazy twist in all of this. So he was fired. I believe he's now banned from the stadium for life, this guy, Ryan Caldwell. He released a statement apologizing, but also saying basically like this video doesn't actually show the full extent of what happened. But people have been chirping about this all week. It's really blown up.
Yeah, it has. And I happened to see the video. And by the way, I mean, you know, as the person mentioned, we don't know what may have sparked this exchange. So I'll say that. But, you know, I have always been nervous as someone who is a transplant to Philadelphia. And I remember being in South Philly with a friend who is a Red Sox fan.
Okay.
And he was heckled.
Yeah.
Heckled really strongly. Just being in South Philly wearing Red Sox gear.
Oh, not at the game.
At the game. So, you know, I know that, you know, there's always some tension when, you know, the non-Phillies fans show up to, you know, the game with their full, you know, and there's always some tension there. So there's always concern. But I mean, the response here was kind of crazy. And this is one of the reasons why I think people do get nervous about Philadelphia fans because of that video.
That's it? Really? Not at the game? Got heckled?
No, got heckled.
Like on the street?
On the street. Got heckled on the street.
Badly?
It wasn't like fight worthy or argument worthy, but they, you know, you typically don't see that walking down other streets.
Yeah.
Like if you were in Atlanta,
I don't
even
know
New
if
York.
I've ever seen that. Basically, take a chill pill, please.
Yes,
don't use derogatory language.
Especially if you work for a DEI-focused company. Yeah.
But maybe while you're taking a chill pill, enjoy a movie. Sometimes that can be a nice way to reset. Story number three.
Yeah. Now, have you ever been in a movie, Avi?
I think you would know if I'd ever been.
Have I ever been
in a movie?
I don't know. Like as an extra or anything?
Oh, okay. Like you're not saying have I ever starred in a movie? Because I'm not.
Just in it.
Don't think so.
Okay,
it was by accident.
Okay, well, there's a chance that you could be in a movie because
little old me.
Yeah, possibly even a Spielberg movie. Why? Because Steven Spielberg is shooting his latest film about UFOs on the Jersey Shore this March. The code name for the movie is Non-View. There's a star-studded cast that includes Emily Blunt, Colin Firth, Philly native Coleman Domingo, among others.
Wow.
And according to Variety, they'll be shooting the film in Cape May for 5 days in March. Nobody really knows what the film is about. But according to the Inquirer, the casting company is looking for Cape May locals to portray train station passengers and drivers in cars.
I could do that. I've done both of
those.
I could totally do that.
Yeah. No acting experience
required.
Put my Studio
2 hat on and just...
And look, the filming is Monday, March 10th to Friday, March 14th. You get paid like 120, I think it's like... For
Say,
8 hours. 216. Yeah, this type
for
of
For 8 hours of work.
216 for 8 hours of work.
Seems
plus,
okay.
If you use your car, you get an extra $37.50 to have your car featured.
Oh, wow. The extra for the car. I don't know if they would want to feature my car. It's not a very attractive.
But you know, that's real. That's keeping it real.
Yeah.
So.
Cape May is also, they shot some scenes for the new Bob Dylan movie in Cape May.
Oh, they did.
Cape May is like the new Hollywood. That's so cool.
That's the spot.
Coming up on the other side of this break, we're going to talk to Representative Madeline Dean about the future of the Democratic Party. Stay tuned for that. Get those comments in, studio2@whyy.org, or call 888-477-9499.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
And welcome back on into Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. President-elect Donald Trump will be sworn into office in just 4 days. He'll become commander-in-chief for the second time, and things look a little different than they did in 2020. This election cycle, Trump won the popular vote, nabbed critical swing states, and made quite a dent in the voting blocks that Democrats depend on.
So this hour, we're talking about the future of the Democratic Party. And we want to begin by bringing in Representative Madeline Dean. She is the U.S. Congresswoman for PA's 4th District, which includes Montgomery and Berks counties. She'll be at the inauguration on Monday and joins us remotely from D.C. right now. Congresswoman Dean, welcome to Studio 2.
Well, Cherry and Avi, thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to join you. We just wrapped up votes for the week. We're all headed home until we head back for the inauguration.
That's right.
You know I-95 and Amtrak well, I'm sure.
I do. Love them both.
Yes. And for our listeners, our question for you today is, what changes should the Democrats make to rebuild a winning coalition? Our number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, you can leave your question or comment in the chat.
Congresswoman Dean, I wanted to start here. I would love for you to give us and our listeners a policy area that you think Democrats should focus more on over the next 2 or 4 years that they haven't focused enough on in, say, the last 4 years.
Well, actually, I would say we have to continue to focus on the economy. Thanks for asking that question. You can imagine we're doing a lot of self-analysis. To say what was it in the messaging this last time around that led to some defeats that I'm very sad about. Senator Casey and two of my colleagues, Matt Cartwright and Susan Wild. We were focused on the economy and individuals' cost of living, but we didn't communicate it effectively. I'm proud of the work we did last Congress, the Congress before, to dig us out of the terrible inflationary cycle. But I get it. People did not feel that we were connecting on what was really happening with their pocketbook, with their monthly budget, with the cost of goods. One of the big problems, as you know, in my district is the cost of housing, homelessness. So I know we have to speak much more directly on the economy in personal terms, tell the personal stories of people and their struggle and how we're going to deliver to make sure they get out of that struggle, and not only get out of it, but succeed through opportunities in the economy.
So what is going to be the strategy for Democrats in the Trump administration? Because you all are the minority party in both chambers. Trump is in the White House. What type of opportunities will you be looking for to get that message out and to create that new vision for the American people?
Well, Cherry, I want to tell you something I'm very excited about. Even as I know we're going to face a very challenging Congress, is two things. Number one, I was appointed to the Appropriations Committee. So there I can directly impact what we fund. I said when I was a state representative serving on the Appropriations Committee there in Harrisburg, you know, how we budget defines who we are. how we budget reveals our values. So I'm very excited that as we go into this new administration, I'll be an appropriator. So my voice can go forward for constituents in my district. The one subcommittee that I'm on that will greatly impact just everybody within my district is I'm on labor, health and human services, education subcommittee. Those are areas I care desperately about. So I think that's one place that we can make a difference. The other thing I want to tell your listeners and viewers is remember, yes, Democrats are in the minority here, but we're in a two-seat minority. It is such a slim majority that the majority holds. You saw in the last Congress, they needed us for very important legislation. And the Democrats are very unified behind our values. Values like, let's get a budget passed, not by way of continuing resolution after continuing resolution. Americans deserve a greater certainty in terms of our budgeting. So between sitting on the Appropriations Committee, being very slimly in the minority, I know Democrats are going to have a very positive impact for our districts, mm-hmm. for our constituents, and for me across Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Speaking of committees, there was a vote among House Democrats last month to pick their leader on the influential House Oversight Committee. And in the end, Jerry Connolly defeated Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, which was, you know, seen as a loss for the progressive wing of the party. Now, this was a secret ballot, but I wanted to ask you if you could say how you voted on that, but also what you take away from that result that many people were very keenly watching.
I actually don't reveal my votes for a secret ballot, but fair of you to ask. And I am so impressed. Alexandria is a classmate of mine. That's what we call ourselves. And I was so impressed with her run. And I actually don't see it as a defeat. I saw it as Jerry Connolly will ably serve on oversight. She will continue to ably serve on oversight and be an extraordinarily articulate voice, as is Jerry, but hers is a different voice. What I saw in the 6 years I've been here working alongside Alex is a maturity of all of us and a growth of her powerfully effective voice. I don't see it as a defeat. She's not going anywhere.
I'm wondering, I want to talk about messaging a little bit, and I'm wondering if there's any takeaways from President-elect Trump, Donald Trump, that you think the Democrats can sort of cling to as they create their messaging to go into the midterms. Is there anything you think that the Democrats learned from watching how the Republicans worked that election in 2024 that they can cling to?
Sure, there are a whole lot smarter strategists than I, and you can imagine there's a lot of conversation going on here and back home in Pennsylvania, across Pennsylvania, in terms of strategy and politics and lessons learned. I worked very hard in the last election, you can imagine. And so my disappointment, while I'm excited that I won, and I won very, very well, I thank the constituents of the 4th Congressional District. I'm delighted to be returning. One of the things that I think that we have to take a look at is turnout. Where was Pennsylvania's turnout? We were a little under where we were in 2020. I remember a couple of weeks before the election visiting Montgomery County Voter Services, and I said, and I, don't hold me to these numbers, but they're about right. I asked the county commissioners, all three of them who were with me on the tour, I said, what was our turnout in the Biden election? And I believe it was somewhere north of 85%, Montgomery County, mm-hmm. registered voters turned out.
Wow.
Which to me, exactly, wow. Which yeah. to me said, oh boy, we better do that and then some. And I believe we came in a point or two less. Yeah. So how do we engage more voters? One of the things my team has learned is that we got to communicate in different ways. That's why I'm delighted to be here with you. We have to find different media that voters are listening to. They're not all reading the New York Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal every day. Many are. But an awful lot of younger voters, as you know, and you can tell me better, are getting their news through very different sources. So Democrats can learn that we have to go and meet the voters where they are. It's a little trite, that expression. But to make sure we're communicating on the platforms where people are taking in their news.
Interesting thoughts there from Madeline Dean, who is a Democrat representing Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District. Congresswoman Dean, thank you so much for the time today. You're welcome back anytime on Studio 2.
Avi and Cherry, thank you.
All right. And coming up, we will hear from a pair of Democrats who offer differing visions on the future of the party. Stay tuned. But we also want to hear from you. What changes should the Democrats make to rebuild a winning coalition? Email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. After significant losses in the 2024 election and just days away from President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration, the Democratic Party needs to rebuild. There's no clear leader and maybe no central message, which could mean trouble for the midterms in just a couple years.
The party is divided over what to do next. If they pivot towards progressives, Democrats risk alienating voters who think of themselves as center-left. If they go after the centrists, will they lose the younger, further left block of voters on issues like immigration and the economy? And what about some of the identity politics that have taken over in recent years? If Democrats abandon that messaging or double down, they'll face consequences either way.
Lucky for us, we've got two great guests with us in Studio 2 for the rest of the hour to talk about the future of the party. Let me introduce Senator Nikhil Saval, who represents the 1st District in the Pennsylvania State Senate. That's right here in Philadelphia. Senator Saval, welcome back to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
And Daniel Fee is a political consultant, attorney, and president of the Echo Group. Dan Fee, thanks for being here on Studio 2.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and we'll remind our listeners today that the question is, what changes should the Democrats make to rebuild a winning coalition? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. I want to start the conversation with a caller. We have Elaine from New Jersey. Elaine, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, my comment. Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
My comment is the Democrats have to distance themselves from the corporate donors and start working for what ordinary Americans care about, like higher minimum wage, health care for all, major health care reform moving towards Medicare for all, affordable housing, and not cater so much to their corporate donors.
Mm, yeah.
What they did to Bernie Sanders in 2016 and 2020 is reprehensible. Right before the 2016 Democratic Convention, Bernie was leading Trump by about 10 to 15 points, and Hillary Clinton was running neck and neck with Trump, but they insisted on running Hillary Clinton instead.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you, Elaine.
Elaine has a very strong thoughts on this, as you can see, which is why I want to throw this question to both you, Nikhil, and to you, Dan. If you were drafting the Democratic Party's 2026 strategy, what would you prioritize and what would you leave behind? Nikhil, we'll start with you.
Thank you. So I appreciate the caller, you know, and the concerns. I mean, I think, you know, I want to say that while we don't know, you know, the circumstances of this election, there are circumstances, right? We had a candidate that changed midstream. We had incumbency issues that affected parties across the world. But one thing that stayed true for many election cycles is Democrats lost working class voters. They had major losses in their core base of voters of color. We did incredibly poorly with young people. And all of that ultimately came down to an inability to address a growing cost of living crisis. You know, if you're a young person in this country, you find that you are unable to afford housing. Half of all renters in this country are cost burdened. They pay over 30% of their income on rent. The Democrats didn't seem to have an answer for those young people. Young people are facing issues when it comes to their caring for their elderly relatives. They don't know how to afford that or how they're going to be able to do that. They don't know if they can afford the cost of childcare. All of these things put a dent in your idea of the future. How am I going to face the future? How am I going to have a sustainable future? So we need to attack all of these issues at once, this growing cost of living crisis. We should be doing meaningful things to address the cost of housing when it comes to rent and the affordability of housing. We should be doing meaningful things to change the cost of childcare, to make it affordable and available to everyone. We should be doing things to make change the cost of elder care and care generally for everyone. And that, yeah, doesn't mean focusing on working class voters and the conditions that they're facing.
And what do you leave behind?
Well, you know, we need to find that the interventions are immediate, right? I think Democrats did do an okay job in this outgoing administration in doing work on infrastructure and climate change, but that people will not feel, frankly, for years. We need to make real interventions that people see and feel in their daily lives right away. Of course, we can do both, right? We need to be planning for a long-term future. But in the near term, how are people seeing that Democrats have a plausible vision and are doing plausible, real things to address cost of living crises in the here and now? And I think that, you know, what we'll have after that is a dramatically transformed economy in which more people can afford housing, more people can afford childcare, more people can afford elder care, and they will see a future that they can build for themselves.
And Dan, what should Democrats prioritize and what should they leave behind in order to win in 2026?
So I think the caller brings up a really interesting thing that some commentators mm-hmm. have already noted, which is that in big picture things, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump were more alike than they were different. And one thing that I think Democrats, particularly the Democratic sort of infrastructure, has never really understood is that Donald Trump is right that government is broken. Democrats are frequently pushed into the position of defending broken systems that cost too much and don't deliver to real people, right? Bernie talked about it. Donald Trump talks about it. The candidates we've had really haven't. So, I mean, I think that what happens when you're talking about sort of like we should expand this program, we should expand this program, we should expand this program, when people already think government is broken and you say, let's go do more with these broken programs, it doesn't work. So what I think that I certainly got my start in the 80s and the 90s, where we talked about Bill Clinton talking about like, let's give people the tools they need to achieve. Let's not have government solve all of their problems. Let's let people live their lives. And I think that that's certainly how Joe Biden ran. It's not really how he governed. It is how Vice President Harris ran. It was not how she ran in 2020. And that's where she got caught.
Well, I don't want to gloss over what Elaine said, the caller, because she talked about distancing the party from corporate influence, right? Mm-hmm. And you could get into the counterfactuals, how Bernie Sanders would have done, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, blah, blah, blah. It's sort of like ancient history at this point to me. But the point stands as like, do you have to say, like, we're not going to take money from these people. We're not going to do photo ops with these people. I mean, what do you think, Dan? I mean, does that help the party regain credibility with the working class?
So the main reason why money is raised in politics is because it is the only way to communicate with people, right? We all pretend that there are like just thousands of volunteers out there knocking on doors. Senator Saval can tell you, doesn't happen. We end up paying for a lot of those people. We end up paying for mail. We end up paying for TV. We end up paying for radio commercial, not here, but all of this stuff mm-hmm. costs money. The way you raise money is you go to people who have it, right? So
there's no alternatives.
There's no alternative, right? We could have a much longer conversation about what has happened to the media over the last 20 years, but I think everyone can acknowledge that it is not as influential as it once was. Mm-hmm. So if you want to communicate to people, you need money. And how do you do it? You're not doing it with $25 contributions. Yeah. You're just not. Right. It's a fact of life. Look, I think that some of the campaign finance laws are egregious and it really has led to some corruption. But no one has ever explained to me how we actually get people engaged without spending money to engage them.
Do you have an answer to that, Nikhil Saval?
You know, I actually think that there are volunteers out there. There are thousands of people who are willing to knock doors for people who they believe in. I think that we saw that actually in Bernie Sanders' campaign. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of people who are authentically engaged in a new, what they felt was a new political project. There were thousands and thousands of people who were not donors to any political party who fueled that campaign. We all remember what the average donation was, at least in 2016, which was $27. I mean, that was a new model, you know, at least in a particular candidate of campaign finance. But I want to be clear that campaign finance is, you know, I think Dan and I agree that it is, there are just egregious issues with how it works, and you know, much can be done to transform it. But people, you know, the Democratic Party will of its own accord adhere to corporate influence or have corporate consultants who are advising their campaigns.
In what way?
Vice President Harris had, David Plouffe, who was a former consultant for Uber, was then running her campaign. You have people moving between corporate clients and presidential clients.
Do you think voters care about that, though? Because certainly Trump does that type of stuff and still seems to have a credibility that he's telling it like it is or whatever among a certain segment of people.
I think it then affects – it has clear effects. A party that is supposed to be the party of the working class is then the party that is unable to message directly to the working class, that is, in fact, comparison with elites. It is a wealthier, increasingly wealthy party. The base of the party is growing wealthier. It speaks in the language of wealthy people. I mean, even the kind of, you know, there was the attempts to go at a cost of living crisis through price gouging. You know, the campaign, frankly, abandoned those issues in favor of, you know, what I would consider sort of elite speak around an opportunity economy or whatever. That didn't really appeal to many people. So I think it has direct influence on the way that the party functions. And so I completely agree that the party should distance itself, not just from, you know, there's corporate donations, and there's also just the viewpoint of corporations, which I think is even much more corrosive in the party.
And by the way, our question to you, our listeners, is what changes should the Democrats make to rebuild a winning coalition? Our number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on the YouTube stream, you can leave your question or comment in the chat there. I want to read this from email from Craig, who says, I think the Democrats would benefit by being better listeners, especially to folks on the other side, to see first how and why others think the way they do. Then truthful dialogues can begin. We need desperately to know one another first as fellow human beings, build trust, then fair compromises have a better chance. I also want to bring in a caller. We have Ray from Riverside, New Jersey. Ray, you are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
So my comment is, I think the Democrats should have a longer campaign. When the 2020 election was over, I noticed there's already Trump 2024 flagged up. So in 2024, it was really hard to figure out who I was voting for between Biden and then Vice President Harris didn't have much time. So I feel like strategically there should be time and effort put into who next and to rally around that person as early as possible to really get into voters' minds, you know, that there is somebody out there.
Interesting perspective from Ray.
Yeah.
And I think where that points us, and I'll put this to both of you, like maybe this really isn't about policy or messaging. It's really about cult of personality and having some very recognizable person at the top of the ticket who you just sort of focus all your attention on and make them the center of everything. I mean, you ask people about Trump's policies and you poll them. It doesn't go so well. And yet, about 50% of the people seem to vote for the guy. I mean, is that the lesson that you would take away from Trump's success? Like, you kind of just need your leader.
So it is certainly easier to organize around an individual who has, rather than sort of like even very specific policies. And that is because people embody it, they speak about it, they're, you know, they do have some magnetism around them when they get to that level. But I also want to draw back. I mean, we've been focused, and I think this question really begins to focus the conversation a little bit, which is this a question about what happened at the presidential level, or is this a question of what happened to the Democratic Party?
Right.
Because this was not 1994. This was not 2010. Democrats did not get decimated across the place.
It wasn't a widespread repudiation.
Right, right. This was a particular problem with a particular race that has very deep impacts right? And it was very problematic. But we picked up seats in the United States House. Of the four seats we lost in the United States Senate, three were seats that we probably shouldn't have held in the past, West Virginia, Montana, and Ohio. The National Conference on State Legislature said that Democrats, out of 7,200 local elected officials, we lost 40.
So, are you saying don't overreact? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is there have been a lot of hot takes that came out after the election. Mm-hmm. Let's figure out what actually happened, right? And the data is starting to come in and show things. Pennsylvania, the Senate's the same split. The House is the same split.
Yeah.
So let's look at this. But I think it goes to what you're talking about, which is that was there a question about the candidates at the top of the ticket and how they handled it? Because it doesn't seem to have seeped through the rest of the Democratic infrastructure.
But I want to go back to the comment that was made, and I want to read this email from Jess, who says, I've really been thinking about what kind of Democrat merch I can wear, because people go out and they make America great again. They have these hats all the time, so why can't I? And I do wonder, because the Democrats, if you think about it, there's no unifying identity per se. And, you know, you think about what Trump did and creating this unified identity. You could spot the people who were MAGA. They had a slogan, make America great again. Do the Democrats need to figure out some messaging that brings people together? Because the Democratic umbrella is so broad. There's so many different ideas and so many people, but there seems to be not anything that really unifies the party in that way to get people energized, Nikhil.
I don't want to overemphasize the question of messaging. I think it's certainly relevant, but messaging, if there's a lack of a message or a lack of a unifying message, that comes from fundamentally not having something to say. And it's a content issue. It's like, what are the Democrats actually proposing? Mm-hmm. What is the vision for the future that we can see and understand? You know, I mean, actually going back to the question of candidates and candidate quality, generally, I think that, you know, as a matter of principle, we focus too much on candidates. We have too much of a candidate-centered politics. We should be focusing more on parties and party building and party infrastructure. But it is worth noting that many candidates who did, say, better than the presidential ticket, you know, spoke to a certain kind of possibility for the Democratic future. For example, Dan Osborne in Nebraska, mm-hmm. not ran as an independent, of course, but, you know, with a working class background, a union background, someone who spoke directly to the issues that we, you know, I think, you know, for example, the cost of living crisis that many of us see as critical to not just this previous election, but elections to come. So I think there is a question of, you know, on the one hand, who the messengers are, but what fundamental issues their backgrounds and or at least their projects speak to. Or is there a project that we can that people can see themselves in? So I really want to emphasize what it is that we're going to do. What is it that party is going to say? You know, I think extending campaigns, I mean, if people get exhausted by politics, let's be clear. And so I think we want to, but they will not, what people don't get exhausted by is a politics and a future that they can fundamentally believe in. And I think that seeing a project in which you can insert yourself is that.
Here's an email from Laura in Ambler who says, the Democratic Party has always been at its best when it's been progressive and looking out for the disadvantaged and working people of this country. You don't fight fascist populism with moderate liberalism. You fight it with progressivism. And Grayson on YouTube, similar message. We have to shift more progressive. Millennial and Gen Z voters want universal basic income. We want all people to get a living wage. Dan Fee, what do you make of that, this idea that you have to go more left? They're talking about, I think, economic left, but you could expand that to social issues as well. I mean, what do you make of that as a strategy?
So I think that it is, I think it's self-defeating, and this is why. Winning the majority of elections is what matters, right? The majority of seats in legislative bodies is more important than winning every argument. Ronald Reagan had this old line that he said that he would take 70% every day. We're trying to win arguments rather than win elections at times. Mm-hmm. So we end up with zero.
Win arguments.
Well, some of that, like, oh, we should be highly talking about, you know, this universal health care or universal mm-hmm. health care. Madeleine Dean talked about this. There's a 3-seat majority in the United States House. I'm sorry, if there's a 3-seat swing,
right.
There were 3 seats in Pennsylvania that were targeted that we lost. So Pennsylvania, if we'd won these seats, Democrats would control the United States House. Northeast Pennsylvania, the Lehigh Valley, South Central Pennsylvania. I promise you the message is different out there than it is here. Mm-hmm. Right? So you have to have a message about the marginal seats because majorities matter. Right? You have to have a message that will allow you to have the majority. And there's never been anything that I've ever seen that says that some of the most aggressive progressive policies play very well in some of these places. Rahm Emanuel in 2006, when the Democrats took back the House, got a lot of flack for getting candidates that could win races but didn't sort of adhere to the Democratic line. We won the United States House, and we enacted a lot of policies for it. I'll take 70% every day.
Did you have a response to that, Senator Saval? I mean, because the, I guess what I'm getting from that is that you sort of need your Trojan horses, more or less, mm-hmm. people who kind of don't talk about the big Democratic agenda, but just sort of focus on the marginal things to win in marginal districts. But maybe you're shaking your head, Dan. So
No. I'm not suggesting that people should be disingenuous or hide what they believe. What I'm suggesting is that they should do what it takes to win their races, and that we should support them and have a broad enough message that they can win it. Whether it's Bill Clinton that, you know, I believe in a place called hope, or Barack Obama, there's no blue or red America, there's only the United States of America. Those are messages we've lost while we've begun to focus on, if you don't believe in this, mm-hmm. you're not a Democrat.
And that goes back to the question of this message that unifies the party, that Make America Great Again unified the Republican Party. But the Democrats don't seem to have that. I want to bring in another caller, though, and make sure we hear from them. We have Kelly from Philadelphia, who says there's one simple solution. Kelly, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Wow, simple solution.
I want to hear this.
All right, Kelly.
Hi, y'all. I mean, maybe that was too quick.
A little ambitious. Yeah.
Okay.
A little ambitious. However, I will say, A, I appreciate all of you having this talk where we're sort of clinically looking at our performance and being strategic and how we move forward. But one thing that I hear folks talking about, and I've heard it on this show, is, hey, we have to combat how unaffordable things are. Oh, childcare is unaffordable. Groceries are unaffordable. Housing's unaffordable. We have to come up with programs and solutions for all of these things. However, as someone, I grew up in, you know, a small town in the Midwest, and now I'm a lawyer in Philadelphia. So I've sort of lived in both worlds. And the folks from my hometown, a simple message is, we want you to make more money. Shareholders make more money, and we've slowly given away our beautiful power that our working class had over time so that shareholders can benefit. And just higher wages, simple. You just need more money. You need to take more from this pot of, you know, beautiful economic opportunity that we've created here in America, so you get more of that piece of the pie. Right now, and I heard you guys talking about corporate influence, I can say, you know, I feel that in both of the worlds that I've lived in, corporate influence is prevalent, and it's hard to get away from. But just, we need higher wages here. Why do we still have a $7.25 minimum wage? It's sinful.
Money.
Thank you so much,
Focus
Kelly.
On that money.
By the way, Bob says tech, big money, academics, elite, university graduates do not need to leave the party planning and strategizing. But the voices of unions, blue collar workers, small businesses need to have an equal, if not greater, voice in the process. I think that's kind of what Kelly is saying. Like, there's been sort of a usurping of the voice of the common person. How do you bring them back into the conversation, Nikhil?
You know, the basic thread I hear in a lot of these comments is just a real horror at the deep, deep inequalities that are driving our society and are transforming our politics. I mean, if you feel, you know, for the caller who mentioned that, you know, the sheer amount of corporate influence and the growth of it, the growth in, you know, corresponding growth in wealth inequality, the gulf between rich and poor, the fact that minimum wages in many states have been, including, of course, here in Pennsylvania, have been stuck at that, you know, poverty, below mm-hmm. poverty level for years. I mean, I think, you know, I think that is a message that cuts across, you know, political and geographic boundaries. I mean, I don't think that there are places, many places, I should say, in the United States that are going to accept a pro-corporate message or a message that is, that does not fundamentally go to the root of our political problems and finds political enemies, right? I mean, FDR.
At the same time, right? Trump is on stage basically hugging Elon Musk and somehow also gets the label of being anti-corporate. Mm. And let me bring in now, actually, this would be a good time to bring in
that clip,
little clip from President Biden's speech last night, warning about the power of oligarchs, right? So let's hear that, and then I'll ask a question about it.
I'm equally concerned about the potential rise of a tech industrial complex that could pose real dangers for our country as well. Americans are being buried under an avalanche of misinformation and disinformation, enabling the abuse of power. The free press is crumbling. Editors are disappearing. Social media is giving up on fact-checking. The truth is smothered by lies told for power and for profit.
And of course, another part of that speech, he talked about sort of this oligarch class. And my question for you, Senator Saval, is can Democrats make that the bogeyman, the enemy? Because Trump loves to find bogeymen to blame everyone's problems on. Can they effectively organize around this idea of it's us, the Democratic Party, versus them, the oligarchs?
You have to, yes. I'll say absolutely. I mean, these are real bogeymen, to be clear, these oligarchs. I mean, we're not making them up. They do have immense power over politics. I think there were many opportunities, frankly, for Democrats, and I think, this is an unfortunate thing, to have really gone after tech monopolies, to have done more to attack the industry consolidating around itself, short-circuiting our media infrastructure. We know there have certainly been stronger efforts to do so, and I think they could even get stronger there. In Europe, for example, to attack, the consolidation of these industries. But yes, I mean, this will have immense impacts on, and it is already having immense impacts on our society. And they're not, many of them are not popular, right? And to the extent that we can...
That's the part I don't quite understand, honestly, because, I mean, I have trouble myself grasping Elon Musk's relative popularity. Like you could come at it from so many different angles. And maybe my question is, are these people popular? Is demonizing them an effective political strategy? Because you mentioned like Democrats haven't done enough, but they might point to, say, FTC, Lina Khan, like they've had... Biden has been no great friend to Silicon Valley. He did make a ton of enemies out there, and it didn't seem like I don't know if maybe they are popular, maybe they're unpopular. What do you make of that? I'm really struggling with it, to be honest with you.
I would say that corporate consolidation over media, technology, and general influence is not popular. I think that's true. I mean, I think that we attacking an industry that enhances the wealth of a few over many, I think is an eminently obvious target. It will, in fact, of course, take Democrats also actually distancing themselves from that industry. I mean, I think that's also there's an incredible level of disingenuousness to that extent. If on the one hand you, and frankly they did not to the degree that they could have, attack corporate consolidation, but then just allow Uber to destroy the taxi industry, for example, or dictate transit policy and all the things that have happened. Yeah. So, I mean, I think you actually have to be real about it.
Yeah, I want to bring in one more comment. We have Sean, who says, getting behind the new president, let go of all these ideologies that are destroying the traditional family and society at large. Stop killing our babies. Stop making lewdness a focus on society. So many things that relate to identity politics that Sean is commenting about. And we only have 2.5-3 minutes left in this segment. But I want to bring that up. Is that something the Democrats, let me start over. Is identity politics something that Democrats need to separate themselves from going forward into 2026? Your thoughts on that, Daniel?
So I think that one of the things that we have done in terms of just straight messaging for Democrats, where we've really been a failure at it, is that we have elevated what makes us unique as individuals rather than what binds us as a community. You know, we are all parents, brothers, sisters, children, everything like that. But we don't necessarily always talk about the commonalities among us. What we do is we highlight for both programs and rhetoric the things that make us different. That's where you start hearing this sort of like real identity politics that comes into it and the push back and forth, right? Whether you're pro-life or you're pro-choice, you do believe a whole bunch of things that are the same. We've allowed by only talking about one and not talking about the things that bind us to allow the other people to talk about the other one too. It's our fault. It's their fault. It's a continuum. We can fix it. They don't want to.
Wow. So bringing people together, finding messaging, it seems like, that bring people together versus separating people by identity. That should be the focus.
And ideology. Not just identity, but ideology.
Senator Saval?
You have to, the risk I see in ignoring the way that there is structural racism in this country and historically that there is, you know, there is real bigotry against LGBTQ people. I mean, I think that the Democratic Party is a broad, inclusive party and needs to focus on its message of inclusion. That's partly its coalition for winning, let alone its humanitarian and sort of moral impulse. And, you know, we've seen a lot of that. You know, I think that we have to be able to speak to people's particular issues and be able to have a moral stance. So I think that it exaggerates the focus on identity politics or identitarian issues as having done damage to the Democratic Party. I mean, it's not borne out in the polling.
Real quick. How do you mean that? Because we have a lot of comments on that.
Well, so the number one issue by orders of magnitude in polling is the economy, right? I mean, the issues around how the Democrats worked or dealt with identity politics was not what cost the election. And frankly, to suggest so, I think, is to kind of lead us down a path of abandoning clear moral stances
and real explanations.
All right. Well, that's Senator Nikhil Saval, 1st District, Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for your time, Senator, and Daniel Fee, political consultant, attorney, and president of the Echo Group. Thank you for you coming in as well. It's been an enlightening conversation. We have to wrap it up. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer, Al Banks. Paul Parmalee and John Kelsey engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory, and Joan Isabella is WHYY's general manager. From Studio 2, I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you all for joining us today.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?